5 News.
This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. In July 1966, Lieutenant Junior Grade Dieter Dingler became the longest-held American to escape captivity during the Vietnam War. His commanding officer predicted his tenacity and perseverance will remain one of the most amazing feats of the conflict. Director Werner Herzog made Dingler famous in a feature film titled Rescue Dawn. Now his fellow shipmate and good friend tells the story of Dingler's courage under fire and how he faced death by ALS years later. Author Bruce Henderson joins me in the studio. His new book is titled Hero Found. If you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can send us a Twitter, join us with a tweet, or join us on Facebook. Good morning to you, Bruce. It's good to have you here.
Good morning, Diane.
Tell me how you first met Dieter Dingler.
Well, I served with Dieter aboard the aircraft carrier Ranger 44 years ago. I have to admit, we didn't meet before he was shot down. There were 5,000 men on the ship. I was on the deck 6 months later when Dieter was expectedly and shockingly returned to us after his escape from really the dark heart of Laos, and looking like a Holocaust survivor, but with the biggest grin on his face. I was one of hundreds of sailors on the deck cheering and whistling and crying and clapping. And in later years, when I became a newspaper reporter, I decided I wanted to look up this fellow. And, of course, I told his story hundreds of times over the years, and we became friends.
He was actually born in Germany.
Correct.
He came here to this country when he was how old?
18.
And had this dream of being a pilot, of flying.
Yes, and in fact, Werner Herzog did a documentary as well about Dieter called Little Dieter Needs to Fly. And it was during Allied bombing of Dieter's small village in the Black Forest when this little boy looked up and saw those airplanes and thought, you know, to fly like that in the skies must be such freedom. And he had this dream, and he came to the United States to pursue that.
He kind of had to finagle his way into that dream, did he not?
I would say Dieter finagled his way throughout life. And we must say that during World War II and the post-war years in Germany, there was great devastation and homelessness and starvation. And Dieter's mother would take him out into the Black Forest and teach him how to forage and how to, if he was ever an orphan on his own, how to survive. These kinds of survival skills, this kind of toughening up of this young boy, as he grew up into childhood and adolescence, I think really was the reason why he was able to survive what he did in Laos.
Did his parents come with him here to the U.S.?
No, the father was killed in the war.
A member of the German
army, and mother was left a widow to raise three young boys. Dieter being the middle son. Dieter was the first of his brothers, and a second one followed. But mom always stayed in Germany.
So how did he manage to survive here?
To survive here?
Yeah.
You mean before
on
Laos?
On his own, yeah.
Well, that's starting on the streets of New York without any money. He was a survivor and so self-reliant. I've never seen anybody who knew as much about as many things and couldn't go out like most of us do and buy that kind of expertise or material, but had to make it with his own hands. He was a tool and die maker by trade, trained in Germany, and could just fashion anything that he needed. And again, he did that in Laos.
So was getting into the Navy a chore? Was it difficult for him?
Oh, yes. Well, first of all, he had to go to college to be an officer in the U.S. military, and he flunked the high school entrance exam in Germany. Now, how is he going to come over here and go to college? He ended up going to night school, and first getting his GED, high school equivalency, then going to junior college, and finally made it, completed 2 years of college, enough for the Navy to accept him into flight training.
And how long did that last?
Well, that was about 18 months of flight training before he was then commissioned and the wings were pinned on his chest.
To what extent did he actually believe in the Vietnam War?
That's a big issue. Dieter told me that for him it was always about flying. It wasn't about going to war. And in fact, it was with great irony that he realized one day that he wasn't just flying, but that he was the bomber in the sky, not unlike the bombers that he saw over his hometown of Germany. And that did bother him. We all believed we were doing the right thing, particularly in the early years of Vietnam. There was a thing called the domino theory. If you don't fight the war there, you're going to fight them on the beaches of California. I fear we still see some of that in Afghanistan and Iraq. But we were over there because that was the job that we were given. We were in the military. Dieter felt the military trained him how to fly. Now he had a job to do.
You didn't meet him until he came back after his captivity, but how did he get along with his fellow pilots?
Oh, well, to this day, I mean, that was one of the real joys of researching this book was I went around and interviewed all of his squadron mates, guys that were in training with him, and they all have Dieter stories. Mm. Dieter did this. Dieter did that. I'll just give you one quick example. He was notified that he could report to Pensacola for naval flight training, but students were not to bring their own vehicles. They were not allowed onto the base. Well, Dieter wasn't going to leave his old Volkswagen camper behind that he'd lived in most of the time that he'd been going to college, and he had his surfboard on top and his skis on top, and I think the thing had two working gears. It took him 12 days to drive from California to Pensacola, and here he pulls up outside the base, and he pulls over and finds a car with an officer sticker on the front bumper, peels it off, slaps it on his bumper, pulls up to the Marine guard at the gate, who takes one look at that blue and white officer sticker, snaps the salute, and Dieter Dingler's in the Navy driving onto the base
with
his car.
Could he have been court-martialed for that?
He certainly could have been kicked out, and this is what Dieter did. There was a bad boy kind of against the grain, if you will. And to a man, the fellows who I interviewed who knew him, they all said, you know, if I had been in the position Dieter was in Laos, I wouldn't have made it. Hmm. Only Dieter could have pulled that off.
Tell me about that secret mission over Laos.
Well, it was secret because we weren't supposed to be bombing Laos. There were a lot of secret missions over Laos, though I wouldn't say it was categorized as anything special. But it was a bombing run over a gun emplacement near a major trail that the North sent supplies down to the Southern Communist forces, and our planes were hitting it regularly. I might say in the 6 months that we were over there, Dieter and I, that the ship was over there, our ship lost a dozen pilots, Dieter being one who went down and the only one who came back. I have a list here of the first 6 weeks that we were over there. If I may, if I can just document Schoonover and Hollingsworth, dead. Hugh Loheed, dead, February 1st. Dieter Dingler, shot down, February 1st. Gary Hopps, dead, February 10th. Waleski, dead, March 1st. Frawley and Christensen, dead, March 1st. I mean, so many pilots went down and never returned. And Dieter became this kind of remarkable story where he was shot down. Nobody knew under what circumstances. And then he did come back to us.
So his survival really became legendary.
Yes. And in fact, he was a bit of a legend even before he went over there. The Navy puts you through what's called escape and evasion school in the desert of California for 2 weeks, mock prisoner of war camp, and they treat you badly and all of that. Dieter set the record again before he went over to Vietnam, escaped three times. Nobody had escaped from this camp in the middle of the desert three times, and was believed to be the only person who put on weight while he was there.
Can you give me an idea of what that survival training was like?
Well, it was in the middle of the desert, which, as Dieter always said, didn't prepare him much for the jungle of Laos, but they dropped you in places and tried to find you. It was about how to evade. It was how to live in the wilderness on your own. Of course, Dieter had a leg up on those guys, having been raised in the Black Forest with his mother teaching him how to do that. And then eventually in this mock POW camp where they had guards there, and they certainly had some limits. They weren't torturing them, but they were hitting them around and taking things away from them and stripping them and interrogating them. And again, Dieter made it out.
Bruce Henderson, his new book is titled Hero Found, The Greatest POW Escape of the Vietnam War. We'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. Join us on Facebook. Send us a tweet.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5.
Coming up Monday on The Kojo Nandi Show, toe-tapping tunes for the holiday. First, Washington's homegrown bluegrass tradition. We find out what bluegrass has in common with jazz. Then we're one-on-one with musical ambassador Angelique Kidjo, mining the connections between West African melodies and American rhythm and blues. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
This weekend, WAMU's Bluegrass Country is having a celebration. Yes, there's that celebration. And there's the celebration honoring the silver anniversary of the Obsolete Music Hour, hosted by the incomparable Dick Spotswood.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Dick Spotswood Show.
Obsolete music. We invented that term because I always thought the best defense was a good offense.
It's a celebration of the red, white, and bluegrass. This evening at 6 on WAMU 88.5.
80 degrees in Northwest Washington, it's 10:20.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
We're looking back at one Vietnam War prisoner and his extraordinary escape. A new book by Bruce Henderson talks about Dieter Dingler, and his new book is titled Hero Found. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Here's our first email. What does the author think of the subsequent film, Rescue Down? After seeing the documentary, I had no interest in seeing the Christian Bale film and still haven't seen it. Does it offer any more true insights into Dieter than he himself did in the documentary?
Well, great question. I preferred the documentary because it was the real Dieter going back into the jungle and showing and dramatizing, of course, showing how he was pushed through the jungle and captured and all of that. Rescue Dawn, however, Herzog's feature film, did a tremendous job at showing the actual jungle imprisonment scene and all of those details. However, Herzog did a great disservice to one American who was a POW over there and who didn't make it out, like Dieter. And unfortunately, he escaped with Dieter and didn't make it the final step to freedom. And Herzog portrayed him in Rescue Dawn as a kind of a Charles Manson type crazy guy. And I think it's the kind of thing that Hollywood sometimes does just because they need, you know,
to dramatize, make something worse than it was.
And this was a Wisconsin farm kid and from a family of 10, and nothing was further from the truth. I mean, Dieter thought this was a great stand-up guy. And Gene DeBruin's family, this POW who was so terribly misportrayed, are righteously hurt by that. So I hold that against Herzog.
What happened the day that Dieter was shot down?
What happened that day? Well, I spoke to there were three other planes in Dieter's group, and these planes bomb one at a time and then pull off the target and go up to meet at a higher altitude. And Dieter was at what they called a tail end Charlie, which was not the best position to be in, because by the time you're the fourth plane coming in over a target, if there's anybody down there with guns, they've got your number. This was changed a bit later in the war when they realized they were losing a lot of tail end Charlies. But Dieter's plane was hit, and the other three guys who were up above at a higher altitude never saw what happened at all. He just disappeared. They couldn't get him on the radio. They flew around a bit, and then they came back to the ship. And the next day, planes were sent back over to the target area, and they found the crashed aircraft. They put a helicopter down. There was no body in the plane, just a crashed aircraft, which meant Dieter must have gotten out. I remember as a young weatherman in the weather office that week, one of his squadron mates coming in and saying, well, you know, one of our guys went down. We found his crash, but he seems to have gotten out of there. And if anybody can make it back, our guy Dieter can. And that was the first time I heard his name.
But what happened once he hit the ground?
Well, he got out of the plane. He doesn't really remember how. He found himself he crash landed the plane. In fact, it was the only open field, he thought, that in the area with all of this jungle around. And as he got low and his plane was losing power, he realized that this wasn't an empty field. This was trees cut off into stumps that were anywhere from 3 to 6 feet high off the ground. And he was now going to crash land on top of these tree stumps. So it tore up the plane. He crash landed, as I say. He doesn't remember how he actually got out of the cockpit, but came awake about 100 feet away from the plane. There was no fire. He gathered himself, heard voices, and immediately took what he could and went into the jungle.
But he was arrested by Pathet Lao pretty quickly.
Within a couple of days, he was captured.
And what did they do to him?
Well, they took him and marched him for days through the jungle.
Literally.
Yes, tied his hands and whatnot. They didn't start really beating him unmercifully until he tried his first escape, which he did a few days later before he got to the POW camp. And they recaptured him by simply staking out the nearest water hole, and there aren't many water holes in the jungle, apparently. And then they really started the beatings and hanging him upside down on from a tree and dropping his head into an ant hive, and even dragging him by a water buffalo, tying his feet and his hands and
what were they trying to get him to do or say?
Well, they basically didn't like him. I mean, he was one of the foreigners dropping bombs on him from the sky. These were not attempts to get any kind of valuable intelligence. they were just darn angry at this white guy who came down from out of the sky from a plane that, bombed them.
One of them was outraged because he was a German and said to him, you know, how could you fight with the Americans when they drop bombs?
Well, that was actually the first real serious interrogation where there was an individual who spoke French and some English, and he was really trying to get Dieter to turn and to write to sign a statement, a confession, and anti-U.S. war policy. And Dieter kept refusing. He said, you know, I just got into this to fly, I'm not bombing civilians, I'm not bombing villages. We're looking for military targets, but I'm really not going to tell you anything more. And again, the beatings started when he refused to sign a statement.
What about his relationship with his fellow prisoners?
Well, there were seven. They ended up being a total of seven prisoners in this POW camp.
Not all Americans.
Three of them, including Dieter, were Americans. One was an Air Force helicopter pilot, Dwayne Martin. The other was Gene DeBruin, who I just mentioned, and he was a civilian employee of Air America, which was the CIA-run and financed airline over there that dropped supplies behind enemy lines. And then the rest were Thai, and then one Chinese prisoner, again, civilian hirees of Air America. Some of them had been in camp for 2.5 years when Dieter showed up. Dieter showed up the first day, met the prisoners, and he said, okay, guys, nice meeting you. I'm going to leave tomorrow. And they said, well, wait a minute, you can't. You have to wait for the monsoons. There's no water out in that jungle. Dieter says, when do they come? And they said, well, in about 3 months, 4 months. Well, Dieter said, all right, I'll wait till then. And the monsoons were a little late, so it took him a little longer than 3 months, but he waited for that.
How many left with him?
All of them. They did a mass escape.
How?
Well, they, first of all, they fashioned a key to get out of the handcuffs that they were put in at nighttime, and the foot blocks. Dieter worked on that a bit, too, from his tool and die experience. And so they were able to get out every night out of their shackles. And they started putting together a plan. They ended up having a hole. You know, they were able to dig a hole under a fence and then cover it up until the appointed hour. And their plan was really to capture all the guards and hold the camp and then signal these planes that flew over periodically. And but what ended up happening on the day of the escape kind of changed that plan.
What happened?
Well, the Dieter was the first one out, and they were going to surprise the guards, who the only time they put their guns down was when they were eating their late afternoon meal, and they were going to grab the guns and then, you know, hold them up like that. Well, Dieter got around the corner, and it turned out several of the guards still had weapons, and they started firing on him. And it was really like a shootout at the OK Corral. Dieter, who also happened to be an expert marksman, killed five out of the seven guards as they charged him with machetes and guns.
But one of his friends was hit by a machete in both the arm and the neck, was he not?
Yes, he had a friend, and this was about 3 weeks later. What they did was they separated once they realized they couldn't stay in the camp because they'd had this firefight. Villagers and other Pathet Lao would come into the camp, would get there within a few hours, so they decided they had to go into the jungle. And they split up into three different groups, and Dieter went with the Air Force officer, Dwayne Martin. And after 3 weeks in the jungle, they were both so near death. And ironically, Dieter was within 48 hours of being spotted and lifted out of the jungle. Dwayne Martin was decapitated right in front of Dieter.
Ugh.
They were crawling along a path, and Dwayne was in front, and the villager popped out, and then came after Dieter with the machete, and somehow Dieter found the strength to just, you know, he wasn't sure at that point he could even crawl any further, but he got up on his feet and ran into the jungle and was able to get away.
Wow. The You know, it does strike me that in situations like that, people behave in superhuman ways. Would you agree?
I think so. But then at some point, Dieter just said he didn't know where he got the strength to do anything.
Yeah.
And if you see the picture that we have of him, he does look like, upon his rescue, he weighed about 98 pounds. He looks like everything like a Holocaust survivor, how he was able to find the strength to go on. He said it must have been something up above there. It must have been his father up there in heaven, or somebody giving him some inspiration and help.
Did you have new material that you added to this book from his own recollections?
Yes, I interviewed Dieter personally for several hours. And also, one thing I was able to do, as I say, in addition to going around and interviewing people who knew him and flew with him, I was able to file a Freedom of Information Act request and get the official debriefing that was, of course, was classified at the time. Several days worth of debriefing of Dieter when he made it out and came back, and all of the, you know, the details.
He had to have undergone horrific circumstances in that jungle, including mosquitoes had to be the least of it, leeches all over him.
He always said the leeches were the worst. And, you know, where he'd go through a stream and there'd be literally 100 on each leg. You couldn't just, if you just tried to pull them off, then they take skin off with them and you're bleeding and then they get infected. And he said that was the worst. And he, for many, many years, had nightmares about leeches in particular.
Bruce Andrews, and his new book is titled Hero Found, the Greatest POW Escape of the Vietnam War. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go first to Frank in Tallahassee, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. Two quick points. One, the author makes a very good point when he says that when you're a prisoner of war and you're being tortured, it's not always to get information. Oftentimes, it's just because they don't like you, or they take some pleasure, or their culture takes over, and you're not necessarily being asked to give anything. The second point, the author early in the interview talked about what's known as SEER school. He referred to escape and evasion school. It's survival, escape, resistance, and evasion. And Dingler gave a lot of credit to SEER school and that 2 weeks. And one of the things that that school teaches that Dingler pointed out in a talk I heard was that when we go around saying, I'll do my best, we really don't know what we're talking about because we don't know what our best is. That we often put forth effort until we get tired or we get bored or we convince ourselves that we can't do anything else, and we say, well, I did my best. And the point that I think SEER School brings home and that Dingler brought home is that we, most of us, have no clue what doing our best really is. I'll take your response off the air.
What a wonderful point, Bruce.
You don't know how deeply you can dig into your own reservoir and spirit. And I think above and beyond sort of the physical challenge of it is the emotional, is the intellectual. And in Dieter, he was driven by this unwillingness to give up. And he wanted to be free and live free again. And that drove him every hour of every day that he was a captive.
When did you begin talking with him?
Well, I met him a few years after Vietnam, but we started talking seriously about doing a book together in the 90s, and frankly couldn't sell it to publishers. Vietnam is still a bit of a publishers say, bring us a World War II book. They sell. Vietnam doesn't. I told Dieter in the 90s, I said, I think that will change eventually, and we'll come back to it, and we'll do this book together. And that was my hope. I went on and did some other books. Dieter ended up, unfortunately, getting sick and passing away. And a couple of years ago, I looked at this and said, well, I'm going to go ahead and do this myself and do it differently than I would have with Dieter. And a bit sadly, to not be able to do it with him, but Hero Found is the result.
But how would you have done it differently had he continued to live?
Well, we would have done it in his first person. It would have been more, you know, his story. And without him, I had to sort of circle him and talk to his family, friends, add in as much information as I could about, you know, the flight operations and what was going on. I cut back in Hero Found from what Dieter is going through in Laos to what is still happening on our aircraft carrier and these other pilots who are flying off on daily missions. And so that kind of, I think I tell another aspect a bit of the story that I...
You talked to his family. You said his wives?
Yes.
Two or three?
Two.
Two. His brothers?
Yes.
His mother?
No, his mother
had
passed
away.
Mm-hmm.
Bruce Henderson. And we're talking about his new book, Hero Found, all about Dieter Dingler. I hope you'll join us and stay with us.
WAMU 88.5 is proud to be a media sponsor of the Smithsonian Institution's 44th annual Smithsonian Folklife Festival, running through this Monday. This year, we'll explore the country of Mexico, learn about the Asian Pacific American communities of D.C., and get a behind-the-scenes look into the Smithsonian. More information is at WAMU.org.
They realized that a democracy required a totally new kind of approach to the society and to education. The people would have to rule, and therefore they had to be educated.
So America's founders intended a free press and widely available schooling. I'm David Freudberg. Join us for a Humankind special, An Informed Republic.
This afternoon at 1 on WAMU 88.5.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And we'll go right back to the phones with Bruce Henderson, whose new book, Hero Found, is the story of Dieter Dingler, his extraordinary survival in the jungles after his plane crashed over Laos. He was picked up by the Pathet Lao, spent numerous months in prison, and then escaped into the jungle. He survived. Let's go to Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Good morning, Sheila.
Good morning. I'm calling about Dieter. I was a friend of his in out west in Marin County in the 80s, and I just wanted to say that he was possibly one of the most upbeat persons, full of life, energy, and positive energy that, I mean, just amazing overall. I was wondering if Bruce had experienced the similar qualities that he emanated.
Sheila, let me ask you a question. How did you come to know Dieter?
Well, I first met him at the beach with his young son, and we became quick friends and long ago, and but I'm just so amazed with this these stories that I'm hearing of him. He never talked about it. I didn't know. I wasn't even aware. I mean, I knew that he was shot down in a plane and et cetera, but I didn't know the circumstances that he went through. And it just amazes me how he was just an incredible person in real life.
Bruce.
Well, this is a good point. You know, Dieter never went around thinking that he was a hero, and I asked him straight out one day, how did he feel about that? How did he feel about being a hero in other people's eyes, mine included? And he said, no, all the heroes are dead. And I think he might have been thinking about, you know, a couple of the guys that he left behind in Laos when he said that. But, you know, about Dieter's personality, I've always said this about him. He was a seducer, not just of women, of men. You wanted to be around this guy. He made you feel good. He was living life large. And I think those extra 35 years that he got when he walked out of the jungle of Laos and had no business surviving that ordeal, I think that imprinted on what he did with the rest of his life. And I say he enjoyed it.
Yes, indeed.
All right, Sheila, thanks for calling. Here's an email from Todd, who's in St. Michael's, Maryland. He says, I saw Werner Herzog's film, Little Dieter Needs to Fly, at our daughter and son-in-law's home. He was bragging about his very new high-speed internet, which he could use to watch Netflix. He asked what I wanted to see, so I said, let's see the Werner Herzog film. I expected to watch 15 minutes and go to bed. Todd goes on to say, we all sat transfixed as this man told his story. No one left. No one was unimpressed. You cannot watch this film without being in awe of Dieter Dingler's determination, bravery, and modesty. The scene where he describes being brought back to the carrier and cannot understand why there does not seem to be anyone around until he gets to the deck is amazing. The admiral had everyone on the ship on deck lined up to welcome him as he was carried onto the carrier, something he did not expect.
And I'll say the admiral also gave up his stateroom, which aboard ship, which is not something an admiral is inclined to do. Dieter got the room, was all of his squadron mates joined him. Dieter picked up the phone, called downstairs to the kitchen and ordered a steak with baked potatoes. And the guys in the kitchen thought the admiral was ordering it. So they served it up with all the trimmings. As I say, had a quality about him even then, as weak and as ill as he was when he came back.
Bruce, describe his rescue for us.
Well, as a matter of fact, the person most responsible is as a resident here in Arlington. He's a retired Air Force colonel. Gene Dietrich is his name. And he was on a armed reconnaissance mission over Laos. And he in June of 66, and this was approximately, although nobody knew it then, 3 weeks after Dieter broke out of the prisoner of war camp. And he flew over a river and saw what he thought was a fisherman waving at him, and the Air Force pilot continued on and then thought, that's a bit odd. In this country, that's considered enemy country, they don't generally wave at, you know, fully armed U.S. aircraft flying overhead. Usually they're running for the jungles. So he circled around and came back, and that darn fisherman, he said, was still there waving. And then he thought he saw something on the rocks, and it looked a little bit like an SOS. And so one thing and another, he called in a helicopter, and he was very, very concerned that maybe this was an ambush. Maybe they would, this fellow would try to get up into the helicopter with a hand grenade and take out the helicopter crew. They really didn't know what they had. But they raised this guy up off this rock in the river and get him, throw him into the helicopter. And, of course, he, as I say, he weighs about 95 pounds and it's so dirty they can't tell what his nationality is. And they start searching him, stripping him down right away, and one of the helicopter crewmen reaches into a pocket and pulls out a half-eaten snake. Dieter had eaten half of it and put the rest away to eat later. And at this point, the helicopter guy jumps back and practically falls out the empty door, or the open door. So shocked. And then Dieter holds on to his leg and just will not let go and says, and is crying, and he cannot believe that he made it. And at that point, the helicopter pilot radioed Gene Dietrich, still flying around, wondering if he'd, you know, somehow been taken in by an ambush and maybe would lose his command or something, and say, you know, we've got this guy who claims he was a Navy pilot. And so there is the pickup of Dieter Dingler in the jungle.
Wow. What a story. Now, the question of the others. There was no other survivor. Is that correct?
One of the Thai prisoners was recaptured and was then rescued in an operation about a year and a half later out of another POW camp. He's the one person other than Dieter who did make it out.
How do you compare what Dieter went through with what John McCain went through?
And the other fellows in the Hanoi Hilton.
Yes.
A much different situation. You know, in Hanoi, they were in a very large secure compound in a huge city, the capital of North Vietnam. Dieter was in a jungle encampment with Pathet Lao guards. I have to say, though, I interviewed one of the pilots on the aircraft carrier at the time that Dieter and I were on the Ranger, was shot down and ended up being in Hanoi Hilton for 7 years with McCain. Or I guess not quite seven. He died, unfortunately, shortly before they released the prisoners. J.J. Connell was his name. But I interviewed other POWs from Hanoi Hilton, and one of them said something rather remarkable to me. He said, you know, none of us ever escaped from that place, but he said it would have been very interesting to have had Dieter there, because if he'd been there, he might have been the first guy to get out.
Wow. All right, let's go back to the phones to Andy in San Antonio, Texas. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. I just wanted to make a comment about the training that we received during the Vietnam era.
Yes.
It never goes away. I had the misfortune of being taken prisoner in Latin America 30 years later. And due to the training that I had in the military, I survived and got out and ruined my health for about 5 years. But back on an even keel. And if I hadn't had that training, I wouldn't be here now.
Well, I'm so happy to hear that, and pleased that you were able to use that and that it saved your life.
Thanks for calling, Andy.
Thank you.
Now to Cleveland, Ohio. Bob, you're on the air.
Hey, I wondered if the author ever heard of Robert Garwood. Before he thought up that title, Greatest Escape Ever. Robert Garwood was a Marine enlisted man, and maybe it was because he was an enlisted man and not an officer, that he never got the credit he deserved or fame. But, he was a POW for 10 years. He managed to, through great resourcefulness and initiative, he managed to survive those 10 years in he was one of the prisoners held back after the war ended, and then he managed to get out. So it seems like, McCain and these other guys who were officers, they get all the glory. But a guy like Robert Garwood, who was, in my opinion, probably one of the greatest heroes this country ever had, you know, he's treated like an outcast.
But did you know Robert Garwood?
No, I was a Marine, though, and I read his story, and I was so impressed. How he managed to escape. He held himself together while other prisoners, officers, and enlisted, careerists, they went out of control. They kind of broke. But he managed to keep himself together during all those years. And he survived so well and learned the Vietnamese language so well that the Vietnamese thought he was a CIA plant. I mean, he was so resourceful you know, just one of those guys that was, you know, able to survive in any situation.
I'm glad to hear about him. Bruce, have you heard his name?
Yes, I have heard his name, and his story is extraordinary. I wasn't familiar, however, that he had written a book. What's the title of the book?
Well, somebody else wrote a book about him. When he got out, the Marine Corps court-martialed him.
Okay.
But what I'm saying is when you read his book and you saw, you know, how he was able to overcome what broke so many others.
Bob, tell
quite
me.
Quite frankly, this pales compared to what he did.
Tell me.
I think you had a guest on your show once that talked about Robert Garwood, to tell you the truth. There was a book, I know it was written about him. And
okay,
was,
but let me ask you something. Why was he court-martialed?
Well, he was court-martialed because they thought he had collaborated. Because he was like an embarrassment to the Marine Corps almost. Because, like I said, he was one of those prisoners that had, you know, he had remained in North Vietnam after the war had ended, and then they couldn't stand the idea that he'd been able to survive the Marine Corps or whatever. They did court-martial him before.
Well, that sounds like a story that needs further looking into. Thanks for calling, Bob, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to a caller here in Washington, D.C. Good morning, William. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I'm a first-time caller, but I've been listening to you a while. I love your show.
Thank you so much, sir.
I'm 79, almost 80 years of age. I was in the Korean War, and I was taken into Reno, Nevada in 1952 to learn a skill as a survival instructor. They opened that base up in the Korean War. And I got injured, and after I was injured in the field, I was assigned to a civilian psychological unit that was brought in to study the prisoners being brought back from Korea who had survived in the Korean conflict when they were shot down. And after about a year and a half or two of study, I don't remember the psychologist's name, but the team, but they decided that there was one common denominator that all who survived had, no matter what their physical condition was. It was simply the will to survive.
Would you agree with that, Bruce?
Yes. As a matter of fact, that was close to an alternate title I had for this book, The Will to Survive. Mm-hmm. And how do you teach that? Where do you get that? And that's a larger question. By the way, this does remind me, when Dieter came back, he made a point over the years of going back to that escape and evasion school, the Seri school in the desert of California, and lecturing and teaching new pilots coming up.
Tell me about his life after he came back.
Well, he went to work, as many of the former military pilots did then, for an airline. And flew for many, many years. His favorite part of that was the free pass that he got to fly around the world. And he'd often come back from a flight and be walking down the terminal at San Francisco Airport and be looking at the gates to see where these various flights were leaving for, and would jump on one to Buenos Aires or wherever he felt, without even going home and changing clothes, and just adventure, loving
his
life.
Mm-hmm. How old was he when he developed Lou Gehrig's disease?
He was 60 years old when he developed it. And it was called rapid onset, I believe, where within less than a year he was losing all his functions.
Yeah. One has to wonder whether the experience in the jungle, the deprivation, the kinds of perhaps even chemicals he was exposed to, perhaps could have brought that on.
Yes, and in fact, I asked that question of several doctors, and they could only speculate. I do know when he took his airline physical for employment, they gave him a form to fill out, and have you had this or that, and yes or no. And the doctor came in the room, and he said, I think you got this wrong. You marked all as yes. And Dieter says, no, I've had all of that. I was a prisoner of war. I've had everything. The airline hired him anyway. But one does wonder whether his system was assaulted so much by what he went through.
He ultimately took his own life.
Yeah, yes, he did. He decided when and where he was going to end his life. He told us some of his friends that that this was worse than being in a POW camp because he couldn't get out. And when it was time, he took his life, and I called it his final escape.
Bruce Henderson, his new book is titled Hero Found, The Greatest POW Escape of the Vietnam War. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.
Welcome to The Global Guru. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Each week we ask one simple question, just one, about somewhere in the world. Today we're in Afghanistan asking, what's Buzkashi?
The rules are very simple. You pick up the goat or the calf, you take it around the flag, you bring it back, and you throw then the circle of halal.
I'm speaking with the president of the Afghan Sports Federation.
My name is Anjumand Ghani.
He's telling me about Afghanistan's national sport, Buzkashi. It's like polo, except in place of a ball.
It is a dead calf that is slaughtered, and the internal parts of the bodies are taken out, and the body is soaked in water for 24 hours in order for the carcass to become a bit hard. And what happens is they cut the leg all the way to the knee.
Okay, so apart from the unfortunate ball, how do you actually play?
You have to have three things. You have to have a horse, you have to have a rider, and you have to have a tool to play with.
And the rules?
You have two teams, possibly 10 people, 10 players or 10 riders in each team. And at a distance, depending on the field, they would have a flag. And they would have another circle in the same vicinity of the first circle. The riders would have to pick up the calf around the pole and bring it back and throw it in this other circle.
That's the circle of halal. And it means?
Something that is pure.
Ghani says you have to be in wicked good shape to play. The calf alone weighs
at least 200 pounds.
And the horses need a